All right, my name's Corey. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Corey.
It's as bad as I thought it would be. I stepped up here last week just to see what it felt like, and I didn't. My legs were shaking then. So, did I say I'm Corey? Yeah, I did. I'm extremely nervous. I'm telling you, most of my life I sought to be the center of attention, and today I want to haul ass so bad I can't tell you. I literally was thinking of any excuse to get out of this. I've been sick all week, and I thought maybe I'll lose my voice. I thought maybe the ice would last something to save me. I told my story, about a month and a half, 2 months ago, I'm not sure, but at a men's meeting. it was a shorter version. It was like a 20-minute story, and I couldn't make it through it. I was bawling like a baby. I'm just really nervous, and I'll give if you don't want to see a grown man cry, you might want to leave now, because I just have a hard time when I look at everything that's taken place, but I will do my best to try to get through it without, I couldn't finish the last time. I got to step 7, and that was it. I guess to just start off, I was born in Upper Michigan, a small town, little paper mill town. What they call rednecks down here, they call woodsies up there. And I was a small town, lived in the woods, spent my summers chopping wood to get us through the winter, and just ran wild as a kid, totally different than what the kids are nowadays. I mean, I take my kids outside and they're scared of bugs, and I lived outdoors, and all that. I was always an extremely fearful kid, self-conscious, shy, I guess, whatever. But it was all to do with self, worrying how I looked to others, and just a lot of fear. I acted out real quick. I had trouble in school from the get-go, and there was child psychiatrists and whatnot, extremely defiant and challenging to the teachers and whatnot. I was a pain in the ass. I drove my parents nuts, and I got into so much trouble. I just was always into something I wasn't supposed to be. I think I was 9 years old the first time I went to the police station for breaking and entering, and I did it because I was trying to get into a house to jump off the house into a snowbank. There had been a big, and the people were out of, they went to Florida for the winter, and I broke in, but then after I had broke in, some other kids went in, and I was just going through the house, and we were going up to the roof and jumping off into the snow. Some other kids went in and trashed the place and stole stuff or whatever, but that was my first encounter with the law, and it was kind of a warning sign of what was to come, I think, because I spent a lot of time later. But I don't remember a whole lot about my early childhood. I just remember being extremely uncomfortable, and I was decent at sports. I've always had the ability to kind of fake it, fit in, but was never comfortable with the popular kids or that kind of thing. I migrated towards more of the outsider types, you know what I mean? And I remember feeling a lot of, I just hated the way people were. I hated the way people judged others and the meanness and the whatever. And I was hypersensitive, so a lot of the stuff that kids would say or that came at me, I just took so to heart, you know what I mean? I just really had a hard time with any of that behavior. And I, the people, like I said, I probably migrated more towards the outside because there was at least you didn't do that to each other, you know what I mean? You didn't, you tried to be a friend to a friend. And I did good. I got A's in my academics and F's in conduct. I was on medicated early and tried to figure out what was wrong with me. I've told people before, my whole life people have been asking me what's wrong with me, you know what I mean? My parents, what's wrong with you? My grandparents, the school teachers, the psychiatrist, what the hell's wrong with you? You know what I mean? And when I went to the psychiatrist and all that, they did IQ tests, and my IQ was extremely high. I mean, and so then I got, well, he knows better, and he's just doing this to be, whatever. And then that IQ test did damage too, because it really made me think that I was something probably more than I was. And I wrote on that intellect and that mind, you know what I mean? And and it caused me a lot of problems later with the program because I just couldn't be taught anything. I knew everything. But anyway, like I said, in my childhood, just trouble from the get-go. A lot of trouble, and I don't remember a whole lot. The big change for me was when we moved to Georgia. I was 13, middle school. And I was coming from a town of like 3,000 people into a high school, Lassiter High School, which had 3,500 kids. And the culture shock was just incredible. The pressure and the groups and the cliques and the fit-in stuff and I thought members only was a club that you had to join or something. I didn't realize it was just a jacket. I'm wearing Kmart striped shirts. I mean, I was just a goof. We didn't know it. Anyway, very difficult. So, again, overwhelmingly uncomfortable with this whole thing and people. And so I immediately migrated towards the heads. The guys in the black and the girl in the black and the drugs, the marijuana or whatever. And I found real quick that it's easy to, mix in with those. All you needed was a bag of weed and you were good with this group. You know what I mean? As long as you had something to smoke, we were good. And then, that connection. So I jumped in pretty quick, and by the time I was 15, I just went out of control quick because I started getting into stealing cars and breaking and entering. I got into a lot of criminal stuff and just destruction, just going out and randomly destroying. A lot of anger, and I'm not really sure what that was, except just the inability to fit into this world. You know what I mean? I was so much frustration and. So I lashed out, and 15, I had stole a truck and was heading to Florida. Had just saved up a bunch of money and was going to Florida and got caught or whatever. My parents put me in a long-term treatment center. This was really only 9 months after I had had my first kind of willful drink. I drank when I was a kid, randomly, and that's one thing that was interesting too. My first drink was I was probably maybe 10 years old or so, and me and my cousin were, my mom and my aunt and uncle were at the house, and they used to, this is the 70s or whatever, so they're smoking weed and drinking tequila or whatever, and we're hearing this hyena laughter from the house. We're outside playing, and we went in to see what it was about. Well, they're just stoned and drunk and laughing their asses off, and there was a bottle of tequila on the table, and my cousin wanted to take a sip, and my aunt said, oh, let them, they'll never want to drink again, you know what I mean? And So he took a sip and he ran to the sink and spit it out and just plop, 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 And I took a sip and I took a gulp. And I guess like most of us, we'll never forget the warmth. And it just bottomed out and then spread. And I immediately was like, wow. But they didn't believe that I drank it because I didn't put on much of a. So my aunt said, he didn't drink it. He's just acting like he drank it, So I'm mad. I'm like, I did too drink it. And I grab the bottle again. And I gargle it. Tequila at 10 years old, first time drinking. And then they all bust out laughing. And I laugh and the tequila shoots through my nose. And then, but I broke out in a rash. I had these huge rash all over my body, On my face, my arms, whatever. And they're laughing. My aunt says, well, you always be able to tell when he's drinking, Well, I found out later that one of the signs of alcoholism is an inverse reaction to the first drink, some kind of odd whatever. You talk about an allergy, that's literally what happened to me. I broke out in a rash. Probably had something to do with it coming through my nose, but it had a reaction, and I'll never forget. And then from there was always the awareness of when there was alcohol around, if I could sneak a drink of a beer or whatever. One day the Kool-Aid and the wine got mixed up at dinner, big family get together, and the other kids were wanting to tell that we don't have the right drink here, and I'm like, this is just fine, we can don't say anything. And that was the first time I experienced like the full bed spinning, and then getting sick and all that. And like I said, it was just an immediate gravitation. I just absolutely, just love that stuff. And the feeling and the escape from reality, I get, from the norm. It's just the different state of mind, that different reality. So I got into Lassiter, I got into the drug, I got into whatever, and I got in some trouble, got put in this long-term rehab. And this rehab ended up having so many lawsuits or whatever. It was just, it was nuts. It was called Straight Incorporated. And it was a run by the kids. So the kids that had advanced up older ran it and kind of, and it was, there was just so much crap that went on in this rehab. It was very volatile. I think it was a six-step program. And, you know, what I did was fight, fight, fight. You know, you got phases you have to get through. I spent 15 months and never made it past phase two. Because I was my rebellion or whatever, and I escaped several times. And, you know, they had convinced my parents that if I didn't finish this, that I was going to die. And, you know, so my parents were scared to death. They didn't know what to do except just keep me in there. Well, finally, I escaped the last time, and they let me stay out. And, you know, I was introduced to AA, my first AA meeting at 15. Well, I was 16 when I actually got out, but I was at a, I went to the, I think it's called the Mimosa Group, or Roswell Group. It was on Mimosa Street up in Roswell. And this is back when you could smoke, and there was just filled with cigar smoke and pipes and old guys. I mean old guys. I don't think there was a guy under 60-some years old, and I'm 15 years old now, you know. They literally had a guy in that group that they brought in that was wet brain that would drool on himself during the meeting and make noises, but they brought him to meetings and would call on him to share, and he'd make some noises, and they'd thank him for sharing, and I was, holy shit. You know, I just didn't see me really belonging there. And but, you know, even at that young age, I was hearing a little bit, you know what I mean, a little bit of what the disease was and could relate, but I was by no means ready. And then, you know, I started the process of in and out. When I was 16, I got in a really bad accident, and I threw myself. I threw a friend totally through the window. We hit an oak tree at about, they said probably close to 70 miles an hour, and it hit the quarter panel. If it had hit head on, I was done. And when I saw the car, I cried. It was that bad of an accident. But and I had a 0.28 blood alcohol, and the doctor was talking to me several hours after, and he said, first of all, with your blood alcohol, you shouldn't even be able to. You shouldn't even be talking to me. I mean, most kids your age would be damn near in a coma. And he just came out and told me I was an alcoholic. And he said, I know you're not supposed to do this, but I'm going to tell you, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to have major problems. That was putting it mildly, what was to come. But, you know, that got me sober I stayed sober for 9 months, and that just amazed me. At 16 years old, I found 8111 and younger people in the rehab groups and whatnot. And, stayed sober 9 months and met a girl that was to drive me nuts for the next 6 years. First love and just absolute madness. I mean, just drugs and alcohol and in and out of jail extremely volatile. And I ended up at one time, we had been together for a little while, and then I ended up with a friend of ours. Her parents wanted me the heck away from their daughter, for obvious reasons. I can't blame for that, but I ended up going down to Florida and was introduced to crack. And, you know, I was when they finally arrested me down in Florida, I was 128 pounds at 6 foot tall. I was doing it every day, drinking gin and smoking crack to the point where it almost killed me. I just am like that with anything that I touch. Any drug I've ever experimented with, alcohol, I'm a junkie. I was just made this way and I can't stop. Extremely excessive and... that definitely, that 9 months in the program, I mean, usually what we do is come to meetings and whisper about what people are, make fun of people. That's what we do. We come to meetings and make fun of the people and make fun of their stories or whatever and criticize. And then, but we'd hang out and it was a distraction just to have people that weren't actually drinking or whatever to hang out with, you know, so it was a temporary distraction. But the seed was definitely planted then because I heard, you know, that we couldn't stay away from alcohol, and I definitely understood that once I ignited that in my body with a drink, that I couldn't stop. You know, I knew that. I absolutely could see that in myself. You know, over the years, what I kept hearing was these older guys talk about being a functional alcoholic, and this became my mission. I was like, if they could do it, I could do it. Because if I could just not get arrested. Hold a job and maybe a relationship, what the hell do I got to come here for? You know what I mean? I said, like, if I could function, I wouldn't come in. So I thought maybe if somebody else had learned to be a functional alcoholic, maybe I could do that. And, you know, I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. So really it's the same thing for the next probably 20 years, 20 some years of just coming into AA for a respite to try to dry out for a little bit, getting stuff together a little bit, getting my head clear, and then going back at it again, going back to jail, and then I just did this process over and over my whole 20s anyway. Started when I was in my teens and went through my 20s, and met people, and again I learned those periods of sobriety. The reason I was able to stay sober was simply by going to meetings and hanging out with people in the program, not working steps, not having a sponsor, not really doing anything, just being here. But I was just buying time every time, but it set up, I think, too, what that did, the damage that did by coming in and out so much was, one, the idea that I can go out, when it gets bad, I can just come back in. And started thinking that, well, if it gets bad enough, I'll just come back in. And if it gets too hard sober, I can just go back out. And if I, you know, and I kept weaving like this, and I became like a, obviously a chronic relapser, but it developed like almost a sociopathic ability to block this stuff out when I wanted to, you know, block everything out and sever friendships and just push everything away and go back to that life, you know, and to be able to do that, because, you know, like people, you hear people say a belly full of booze and a head full of AA, you know. Well, I learned to kind of blot that out to an extent, but would come back when things got rough. And I mean, I spent over 10 years in jail. I've been in hospitals for broke my head, ribs, nose, jaw, cheekbone, overdoses, suicide attempts. I think I've been in 6 or 7 rehabs in my younger days. Just a really slow learner, it was just the discomfort, though. I just could not. I was so uncomfortable sober. I'd get to a point where the anxiety and just feeling like I don't get how you people do this. You know what I mean? I don't know how. I couldn't understand. It still blows my mind when I see kids that are 25 years old practicing some profession and making the money. I work for people and they blow me away. Younger people, I just could not figure it out. I could not. I didn't understand and was overwhelmed. But as it progressed, I guess I think I was 28, somewhere around there, and I was 26 when I got out. I got out of prison. I did a couple years in prison. And I got out, and I met a guy, and he started doing tile work with him, and I worked for him for a couple of years, and then quit and went out on my own and started kind of doing that thing, and started coming to me, and it was shaky. But anyway, I ended up with about 3.5 years sober. I met a girl, and she thought I had more time. We got pretty close, pretty quick, relapsed together, and had a pretty in-depth relapse. I ran up about $60,000 on credit cards, and I was working, and it was I was introduced to narcotics, and I thought my alcoholism was cured. I really did, because if you do enough narcotics, you don't want to drink. If anybody's experienced that, you want like ice water in a cold towel or something when you throw up. But it was just a whole different world, and I really thought, shit, this is great, because I didn't experience the out of control in the sense that I didn't get all volatile and crazy like I did when I was drinking. It was a little more functional, I guess, maybe. But the money ran out, and so that ran out, and so I was back to alcohol, and I had to go face some time. This is the last war story I'll tell, but you know, this is kind of classic of what would happen. I think I had a. This is before we had met, right before. I had to face the time we were together, but I had about 7 months sobriety, maybe 7.5, and I'm doing my thing, going to meetings, hanging out with people in the meetings, and I was actually helping a guy, blind leading the blind, but, you know, was trying to help this guy who was younger and whatever, and trying to take him to some young people's meetings, just befriend him and, you know, help him stay sober. And he did stay sober. I think he's got like 12, 15 years now, you know. But anyway, this just shows you, like, this was like the epitome of insanity for me. Me and this guy had went to a meeting. I picked him up. We went to a meeting at Freedom Club, and it was a very small meeting. A couple people were there, so the meeting wrapped up quick. Well, I asked him if he wanted to hit another meeting, and I was going to come up here for the 10 o'clock meeting. And he said he didn't want to come. So I dropped him off. Now I'm on my way to the 10 o'clock meeting at Howe Place. No thought of drinking. I'm trying to stay sober. I'm trying to, you know, stay away and go to meetings and whatnot. And I'm on my way, and I came up a road, and I passed a bar that I had met a waitress in when I was drinking and never went back to. She had told me to come back, and I never went back. Now, that just as quick, the thought, oh, yeah, I never went back and talked to that waitress. And she was cute, you know, and I'm thinking that. And it's in my head. By the time I get up, maybe 5 miles later, I'm at the liquor store. I'm on my way to a meeting now. Totally no thought of drinking or anything. This one thought comes in my mind about a waitress, puts this in my head, and I'm at the liquor store. Well, I went across the street and drank at a pool hall, and when I left, I was way too intoxicated to drive, and I was like going around the parking lot with my truck, yelling at somebody, I don't know, some craziness or whatever. They had called the police. Well, I ended up with about 25 police cars behind me going down 92, and high speed, low speed, high speed chase, and you know, I remember looking in my rearview mirror at all the lights, all the police lights or whatever, and smiling, thinking this is awesome. I mean, it was entertaining to me, you know what I mean? And then I realized, well, I'm going to have to, you know, and then I got in a neighborhood and I ran from them, and they caught me, and I went off on two. The police officer put two of them in the hospital, and I was looking at some serious charges. And, you know, the next, I kind of blacked out, pepper sprayed me, blah, blah, and I woke up the next morning in full restraints, like a six-point restraint in this chair that they got in the jails, in the middle of all the dorms where everybody can see, you know what I mean? And in my underwear, and eyes all red and puffy, and one of the deputies, a female deputy, she said, are you ready to calm down or whatever? And I said, yeah. And she said something. I said, how bad is it? And she said, it's bad, you know. And so then I'm wanting to cry, and she had mercy on me, took me out of the view of everybody. And I was looking at that case. I was looking at 10 years mandatory sentence. There's no. It was one of those where there's no. The judge has no way to change that. And I was guilty as hell. And you know, it was actually a woman in the program who had been DA, who I was friends with, and I had done work for her at her house. And she was DA in Cobb County, and she had just gotten to private practice. And had it not been for her, I would have had to do that time. But anyway, so me and this girl went, we relapsed, and then I had this time come that I had to do for this case, which was minimized greatly. It was about 7.5 months, and yeah, which was just phenomenal that she was able to do that. I've been blessed so much throughout all this, saved from so much. I should have been dead so many times. Anyway, so that 7 months got me sober. And when I came out, I had lost my license, and Carrie had gotten sober. You know, I had stopped about 2 weeks before I had to go in, as did she, and she had gotten sober and gotten involved with the groups that I used to go to, or whatever. So I got out, and I was not, you know, necessarily gung-ho to get sober or go back to meetings or whatever, but I was in, you know, I was on intense probation, and I was facing that time if I didn't, you know, behave or whatever. I didn't have a license, so my dad started working with me. You know, I was doing the home improvement stuff, and it really took off fast. It was just a good time, good economy or whatever, and so we stayed together, and I actually ended up with about a little over 3 years sobriety. But never really did any of this stuff. You know, I did some of it, and you know, I practiced some of the things, but never really worked with anybody, never got into the book, never did the steps. And then this relationship, now this is a fun one, you guys will like this. Some of you know it, but so I'm in this relationship, and me and Carrie got along really good. We didn't have a fight for the first 2 years. It was a very easygoing relationship for the most part, and we've got a big host of friends. We relied on a lot of people for rides and stuff, so we got to know a lot of people in the program. And then we had a child. She got pregnant, and we had my first son, Christian. And, you know, I think that did a lot to make me want to, you know, to stay sober and want this life and want to, you know, raise a child and whatnot. And then, well, I guess at about maybe 2.5 years, we had our first son, and 9 months later she was pregnant again after having tubes tied and soldered, and it was kind of a miraculous thing. All right, so, well, after my when I met Carrie, and this is, Carrie was my typical type of woman, very promiscuous. I mean, this is the type of women I liked, you know. I think the first, I don't even want to get too much into that, but I was attracted to a certain type of woman. She fit the bill, you know, ex dancer, heavy into drugs, even prostituted. You know, none of that scared me. I liked it. I was okay with that. And this is the kind of people I was. But she changed tremendously. Sobriety did a lot. Anyway, after our first, this issue comes up, and the issue is that she. And I had got a preempt to this the first time we were together. She had said something about she'd always had a fantasy about being a guy. Okay? This is all I got. Now, this was the first time we got together. It's the only thing I ever heard of it. After my first son now, this comes back up. This resurfaces. And I'm like, well, what are you talking about? And then it became, well, I think I'm a man. Now, I'm going to tell you, I did not take this well. And I just didn't. I didn't know what the hell to do with it. I thought she was absolutely out of her mind, and I didn't know where. I just couldn't comprehend any of it. And, you know, meanwhile, now we've had our second son, so we got two kids under two in the house. My business has just went nuts. I mean, my business has taken off. I'm getting 10, 15 calls a day. I've got 7 guys working for me. I can't keep up. I'm not willing to let go of control enough to I'm micromanaging at 80 hours a week. I got 2 kids crying. I'm up in the middle of the night, and now I got a wife that says she wants to be a man. And you know, I said in the men's meeting, I said, you know, sobriety was starting to lose its, and the resentment was starting. You know, I mean, the resentment of, why did you do it? Why would you have gotten involved with somebody and had children if you knew this? But you know, it's like sobriety. I think for a lot of people, it's a revealing process. And she said it had always been there, but it's something she'd always put down and put down and put down. As she got sober, it became to become more of a reality. I can talk about it today in a much more accepting way, but that's over years and years of working through this stuff. Because at first, the rage and the anger and the resentment were so fierce. I mean, at the worst, it was murderous. She ended up, I relapsed and ended up, ran off with one of her sponsees. And using with her, and she, I came home one day and everything was gone. The kids were gone. She was gone, and that was absolutely devastating. I love my kid. I mean, who doesn't love their kids? But I really, you know, it was just, it was a lot, and disappeared, and I couldn't find her, and I couldn't see them, didn't know where they were, and you know, it really liked to kill. It liked to kill me, and like I said, the resentment got to a point where I literally, you know, when you see people on the news that they talk about that they killed their whole family and then killed themselves, I was absolutely there. I don't say that lightly at all. I mean, I was literally had the gun she did very wise by moving very far away. And, you know, and it was probably drunkenness that kept me from some of that behavior. I just got so drunk, but I just sat and festered in that resentment and that anger and the depression about losing my kids and whatnot. And, you know, tried to come back into AA a few times, and you know, by that time years had passed, and I think then the guilt of not being a part of my kids' life, of missing all that time, of losing them, you know, every time I got sober, it was like I had to face all this stuff, and I just couldn't face it. I just couldn't deal with it, and I couldn't let go of the resentment, and you know, I'd typically fall into the same pattern. Every time I tried to get sober, I'd end up with a girl, and that I probably shouldn't have been with, and then, you know, relapse and do it over again that last couple of times. Anyway, I'm so distracted here, but the last couple times, you know, I think the last time I tried to stay sober, I made it about 6 months, and I started to look at this resentment with Carrie, who's now Kurt with a beard. And, you know, having to address this and having to come to peace with that. And I still was fighting it, I think. And I still had so much issue. I just didn't want my children being raised with that. I looked at it as such a twisted thing I didn't want my kids to be any damn part of it, but I was powerless to do anything because I'd lost custody and I had no grounds to fight on. In and out of jail with my record, I just had no way to get them out of it, you know. So anyway, so the last periods of my drinking, the last two long periods of drinking were just absolutely the darkest times of my life. I ended up so alone, just absolutely isolated in my own little world. I severed every relationship with anybody in AA, and I worked just enough to get enough to drink. I was squatting in a house that me and my dad had agreement on. I wasn't paying rent or bills or anything. I was drinking enough I was working enough to drink, and I had, you know, the blinds stayed closed, and I had a little piece of paper taped over the window so there was no chance, and I wouldn't answer the phone, and I just drank and drank and drank, and started to understand the physical addiction of alcoholism, and would try to quit or try to get a few days in, and then experience what happens when you're physically addicted to alcohol. That day three is just too much. I couldn't break past it, and I don't know. When I came in this last time, I was facing a little. I'd gotten a little charged because I learned if I venture out, I'm going to get arrested. But I'd get lonely, so I'd venture out, and it never worked. But I always, you know, what ended up was I get arrested. So I did, and I was facing some charges, and I knew I had to sober up. I was going to be looking at a test that would be high for alcohol. It's this new test, and it, very accurate for alcohol, can read it up to weeks before or whatever. So I came to the Howe place, and I'd never been to this morning meeting. I started coming to this morning meeting, and at first my detox medication was marijuana, some really good weed, which I didn't even smoke weed, but I just wanted something to ease the transfer. And but I'm going to tell you, the combination of this really good weed that I wasn't used to and coming in here and hearing the people at the Howe place, the morning meeting specifically, boy, something hit me, and a message got through, and I think that, you know, I kind of remember the day when I just said to myself all this time, 26 years and out of the program, and I'd never given the program a chance. I'd never given these steps a chance to work in my life. I'd never put the effort in to see if maybe this would work, and I don't even know where it came from ever, but the willingness came. And finally, enough humility to realize that I didn't know it all. I don't know what the hell I'm doing here. And the disease had got me to a point where it was either try this or die. It had really got to that point where the two choices were all I had. It was either the bitter end or try this, you know. And I made a decision to try it, and I knew I had to get a sponsor. One thing that I just detested, the idea of answering to any damn buddy. Don't tell me what to do, you know, that whole idea. But I got a sponsor, and I prayed about the sponsor before I got one. You know, I just said, all right, leave me. And this guy kept coming up in my head, and I'm telling you, this guy annoyed the living hell out of me. He was a big book thumper. He had all this information. He just loved the program, had all this zest and zeal, and was always just happy, and I couldn't stand him. I was like, you are way too into this AA thing, you know what I mean? But I'm praying, and his name keeps coming up, and I'm like, damn. But, you know, I got to a point where I was, like, willing to try to get outside the comfort zone and do something with it. So I asked him. Turned out to be just the best thing I could have ever done. He, so much alike, not only in the alcoholism, but maybe some of the mental, emotional issues, you know what I mean, outside of the realm of AA. But and he's just been great, and he never told me what to do. Never preached to me. He just shared his experience. He did an excellent job of being a sponsor. He shared his experience, strength, and hope, period. Where other sponsors would scream at me, no, you don't need to do this. You don't need to do that. You don't need to see this girl. You don't need to do that. No, you're not ready. He never did any of that. He let me make my mistakes. But, you know, when I did go jump in a relationship right away, he said, listen, I'm not going to tell you not to get in a relationship. I'm just going to tell you if issues start to arise, don't feel like you can't talk to me about them. Because I'm not going to make you hide or tell you you're wrong. But just keep the communication open. Talk about it. Much better than telling me not to do it, because when you tell me not to do it, I'm not calling you. And then when the stuff hit, I didn't have anybody to, you know. So he did a good example of what a sponsor was. But, you know, the first step to me this time, it took on a different feel, a different look, I guess. When I looked at my disease, I understood the physical allergy, and I understood the mental obsession. Got that years ago. When I was 16 years old, I got that. I understood that. What I looked at this time was the spiritual malady. You know, the book talked about we were suffering from something that only a spiritual solution could solve. So I began to look at the disease itself as a spiritual thing, an oppression type deal. I had to look at it like that because that was something that I couldn't mess with. I didn't have the power to overcome the spiritual, whatever the heck it was, disease. And I needed God's help. And when I saw it that way, and I saw my disease as an attack on me, I don't know, it worked for me to look at it like that, as to look at it almost like an entity, something that was way too big for me and that I needed God's help with. And then when I came to the second step, I think a lot of it was, first of all, you know, not trusting myself at all, not trusting my mind really at first with anything, nothing. Anything I think's usually going to be bullshit. Can't trust it. Can't rely on my head. I need to use somebody else, run stuff by somebody else, and I need God's help. I can't rely on me, you know. And that was big because I held so much. I for most of my life, it was all about me and what I thought, and it was so important that I just thought I knew everything and I got this. You know what I mean? So hard for me to humble myself and listen to somebody else. And that's what the second step was, is listening to you people and listening to my sponsor and reaching out, you know, and starting that process of trying to reach out to God and find that. And I really did. I dove in. I got into Nivelco, that's an accelerated step program, and I dove in. I got a freaking highlighter and a big book, and I went to town. You know, and this is not me now. This isn't my normal stuff to sit at home with a highlighter and highlight the big book. Totally against what I would choose to call a fun time, but you know, I absolutely did it. And all these steps I wrote in a notebook. When I read something in the big book that jumped out at me, I wrote it down in a notebook and I highlighted and I studied. And I 26 years, and I thinking I knew it all. I was astounded at the stuff that was in this book. It was amazing. They knew exactly who I was and what I was about. They knew what I was thinking. They knew how I felt. They knew what would they explained everything and told how it would happen. Imagine that, all these years. Textbooks right there and never paid attention. And, you know, and it really happened fast, you know, because I just, the willingness seemed to build on itself. This momentum seemed to just kind of fire me. And you know, the third step, when it talks about the third step promises, I experienced those promises at the third step. I had that feeling of release. I had made a decision. I was going to seek God, and I was going to try to live a different way. You know, I had jumped into a relationship when I first came in, and I was seeing a girl that was the same type of girl that I always was with, you know, and she was going to meetings or whatever, but we went to a meeting, and the whole meeting they were cutting up and making comments. It was just a joke. It was an Alpharetta, and it was a night meeting, and it was a joke. It wasn't even an AA meeting. It was just ridiculous. Crosstalk and you name it, just... And it upset me. It really bothered me because I've been going to the Breakfast Club and I cherished the way people presented this thing and came out of the book and whatever, and they're making a joke. Anyway, she made a comment. She said, well, if you want a spiritual girl, I'm not the one, you know. And boy, it hit me. I was like, what the hell are you doing with this person? You know what I mean? I packed up my stuff and I got the hell out of there and I didn't look back. And that was at step three, really. And I went into the fourth step, and after resisting this again for 26 years, now I'd taken a disclosure fourth step where I told all my secrets, and that was helpful, you know what I mean, definitely, to let all your skeletons out and all that changed me a lot. It made me feel not as different, maybe, but I didn't get to the real purpose to me today of what that fourth step is, to identify what's keeping me from God, you know, the blocks. And so I got into fourth step this time. I you know, it was all just right there. It was easy. It wasn't a struggle. It was all coming. This whole process seemed to come naturally when I was just willing to go into it. It all just kind of came. So put together a four step and met with my sponsor out here on the picnic table. And, you know, doing the four step just seemed matter of fact. It just seemed like we're just looking here. You know, let's get a picture of what the problems are. What needs to be, you know, avoided and what we need to address or whatever. Didn't feel like it anything until I got done. And I was on my ride home and the emotion hit me. Just this wave of, I don't know what the heck it was, but this huge, that's where I'm going to get choked up. huge emotion. So I got home and I didn't take the book off the shelf, but I did get on my knees and take that six and seven step. And this was probably the biggest turning point in my sobriety, because I don't know what it was. It was like it was a cleansing. It was just something went, something happened. And when I said that prayer and I offered myself to God, I gave every, I mean, at that point, I don't think I could have been more sincere in surrender. And, you know, I heard a, I had a thought come, and it felt more like a, I mean, I didn't hear a voice, but it was definitely a voice in my head that said, you never have to be that way again. And that stuck with me. I mean, that, that's really what this all about, is that God will give me enough grace that I don't have to, not only don't I have to drink, but I don't have to live in turmoil and in all the stuff that happens, you know, because even sober, even when I dried out, there was still all the turmoil in my life and my relationships and all that. And, you know, I just, I've learned so much, and so much has been healed. And I do drift back to that guy, you know, occasionally. I guess we all, you know, we all do. You get away and start, stop doing the things and kind of go revert back into that old type of person. But I don't have to. I don't have to pick up a drink, and I don't have to be an asshole today. I mean, that's what it comes down to. I have the tools to live differently. And when I practice it, when I practice these things, the peace that I have and the happiness that I have and the joy that I experience in my life is indescribable. I mean, I really, I spend so much of my time, you know, laughing and just enjoying, you know, and it's not like my life is a bed of roses by any means. A lot of stuff, a lot of financial, you know, things that used to be a big deal, but they're just not a big deal today. I have faith that it's just, it'll pass and my needs are met. And and anyway, getting into 8 and 9, a lot of 8 and 9 for me was a living. You know, I had to. I had said I've been telling people I'm sorry my entire life, and I truly was. I hated the way I acted when I was drinking. I couldn't stop drinking, so I just did it over and over again. And so sorry just wasn't going to cut it, and it really had to be shown. And I had to take a lot of stuff. You know, my family, I think once they realized that I was safe in the sense that I was sober and I wasn't drunk and going to lash out and be physically maybe dangerous, they started unloading the crap about, you son of a bitch, you did this, you did that, you did whatever. And I was getting these attacks, and you know, I had always defended myself. I had always defended, no grounds for defense. I had nothing to stand on, but I would defend myself or whatever. And you know, I had to take some stuff for a while. I had to allow them to express the pain that I had caused them, you know what I mean? And but then I had to just keep being there and keep doing things differently. I mean, when I went over to my mom and sister lived together, my sister moved in when my dad died, I'd have to pray in the car before I went in the house to keep this shut and to just try to demonstrate the principles, you know what I mean? And I didn't always do well. You know, there was times where I lost or whatever, but I've gotten so much better. And then the healing that happens when I practice that, when I just practice my part, and they start changing. And now it's like, you know, it's just a totally different. My sister, not so much. She's a hard one. She got hurt deeply by this whole thing and the whole what happened to the family, whatever. But my mom's definitely come around. It's gotten better with my sister. And then 10-step. 10-step is the biggie. I mean, that's really, to me, what became, this is how you stay sober on a daily basis. You know, this is the guts of what we do, is that constantly being aware of what's going on in my head, you know what I mean, where my thinking is, what my motives are, all that kind of thing, and then asking God for help, you know, and choosing not to play with these things that I know are bad for me, like resentment and judgment and criticism and anger and fear and all this, you know what I mean, don't play there, don't live there, you know, I don't have to stay there. I ask God's help, I talk to somebody, and we move on. And what I found is, you know, that whole process of, like people said, about getting rid of this, you know, it's giving up my stuff. It's giving up my, what I held on to so hard. It's just giving it up and saying, I don't know. And just doing the right thing, just taking the next step. And God puts new stuff in. And I end up thinking thoughts that are beautiful sometimes, you know, not all the time, but But it happens. You start to realize. I realize my thinking has changed so much, and it really wasn't. All it was me being willing to let go of my old thinking. You know what I mean? And God fills me back up with decent thoughts. You know what I mean? I feel like most of the time I feel like a good, decent person today, and that's just not how I felt. I hated myself. You know, I loathed myself. Couldn't stand to look in the mirror, and it works. It really works. You know, 11, I'm not as good at on the meditation part. I do try. One of my big things, and one of the things that helped me tremendously in sobriety is music. I used to listen to very loud, guttural, I love the anger music, pissed off guys singing. And today I listen to The Fish, you know what I mean? That's all I listen to, and it's all I want to listen to. I love that music. It inspires me. It brings me to tears. It keeps me full of gratitude. It keeps me remembering that I myself am nothing. It just keeps me in the idea of God. It grounds me. And that is, to me, a lot of times, is my, it's like meditation. The physical stuff, you know, the working out, that's another thing that was huge in this period of sobriety, was learning the natural stuff, the way I can naturally get the release and the relaxation. Just a great work, you know, go out and work out and enjoy that calmness that comes after, you know. It's similar to what the narcotics used to do. I actually, when I go get a good workout and I get done, I take a shower and I sit down and relax, I feel that calmness, you know, and my brain seems to function better. So that's been a huge part. You know, the 12-step, I've had a few little things with sponsoring people, not a whole lot. But you know, and I had one guy, and I just knew I knew he wasn't ready, because he wouldn't, you know. I told him what I did, and he didn't want to do any of that. So, but you know, I kept talking to him, whatever, and he got out of his probation, and he ended up in Ridgeview, whatever. And I haven't talked to him since. And then I actually worked with another guy that had a lot of sobriety, but had been away from AA for a long time. And but you know, a lot of it is just showing up in these meetings, and when I see people come in, and I know they're struggling, I just try to share some, you know, it's just being encouraging and telling people what's happened to me, just testifying to the fact of what this program can do, you know. I mean, it's just, it really is, like I said, it's amazing. And it's hard sometimes not to look back and regret that I didn't give it a shot early, because, you know, there's no telling what my life would have been, but it is what it is. And I begin to see the benefit of all the experience and the time in jail and the in and out, you know. Just the fact there's a lot of people that that go in and out, in and out, in and out, and I can say I get that, you know what I mean? And I didn't, I kept coming back, and today, you know, it's okay, and I don't have to drink, and life is good. But I don't know. I'm just extremely grateful. And like I said, this Breakfast Club, I just owe so much. I really, you know, I'll say this and I'll be quiet. There's a guy that had been coming into the Breakfast Club, and I started seeing him. He was gung-ho, and he was doing them. He was working with a sponsor, and he had a lot. But then I started seeing him. I started seeing the, you know, the struggle coming back or whatever. And it was a couple weeks ago or whatever, and I didn't want to go to the meeting. I wasn't planning on going to the meeting, but I thought of this guy. And my intention to go to the meeting that morning was simply for him. It was not about, I didn't want to go to the meeting. I didn't need to go to the meeting. But I thought, you know what, I just want to go and say hi to this guy and encourage him, whatever. And I did. And when I did that, I realized that I thought of all the people that were there when I was coming in. I thought, I wonder how many of those people, when they shared or when they were doing it, and thinking of me and thinking of the new people in there. And I realized probably a lot. You know what I mean? It's what we do. And so I'm just extremely grateful. And I did pretty good for not. I appreciate it. Thank you all.